This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My co-host Anthony Brooks is on assignment today. Well, what a week it's been. On Tuesday, voters elected Democrat Ed Markey to the U.S. Senate.
Thanks to the opportunities this country gave me, this son of a milkman is going to serve the state of Massachusetts in the United States Senate.
On Wednesday, the Supreme Court issues landmark rulings on the Defense of Marriage Act.
And we won everything we asked and hoped for. Wow.
Closer to home, Patriots tight end Aaron Hernandez was arrested for murder.
The evidence will show the defendants had the motive, the means, the opportunity to perpetrate the crime.
And on Thursday, a federal grand jury hands down a 30-count indictment of Boston Marathon bombing suspect Jahar Tsarnaev.
It's been 74 days since the explosions. Since that time, the city of Boston has begun to heal. Today is an important day in that healing process.
Which brings us to today, Friday, and our Week in Review panel. And joining us now to discuss the week's news is Nancy Gertner, Harvard Law professor and former federal judge in Massachusetts. Nancy Gertner, great to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Also with us is Scott Lehigh, columnist for the Boston Globe. Scott, it's great to see you as well.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the news that just came out yesterday regarding the 30-count indictment against suspected marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev. Here's Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis at a press conference yesterday.
This case is about our community. It's about an assault on our people. And I look to Carmen Ortiz, the United States Attorney's Office, the prosecutors here, and the judicial system to hold this man accountable for the terrible things that he has done and hope that nothing like this ever happens again.
The indictment is 30 counts, as we said, and includes a charge of using a weapon of mass destruction and also an allegation that Tsarnaev left a confession in the Watertown boat where he was hiding that says the U.S. government is killing innocent civilians. I can't stand to see such evil go unpunished. Nancy, let's start with you. The indictment wasn't entirely unexpected in the counts that were included in it, but what's your first reaction to it?
Well, the counts are counts that would enable a death penalty. And it seems to me that that's the option that the government wants to leave open. So the mass destruction, using a weapon of mass destruction, et cetera, are counts that enable a death penalty. The scope of it doesn't surprise me, nor does the allegations in it. It seems to me the allegations are what we have heard about. So it really is, it seems to me the next question is going to be whether the government is going to seek the death penalty. It's an interesting question. When this first happened, I thought about if Tamerlan had survived, whether or not one would look at Jahar the same way. Mm-hmm. Tamerlan had survived, one would have looked at him as the death penalty eligible person and the younger brother not. I don't know whether that's any different now, but it's an interesting question.
Scott, what's your take?
Well, it seems to me that clearly they're trying to say here in the indictment, this is not just a tag-along little brother. This is someone
right.
who was completely and thoroughly complicit in all these acts. And so, as Nancy says, is completely eligible for the death penalty as a result of it. And I do think, I mean, I expect they would. I can't imagine that they would say we're not going to seek a federal death penalty in this case. It wouldn't make any sense to me that they wouldn't. I mean, it seems to me that the sort of the modus vivendi we've arrived at here is that in New England, it's more or less the feds that, you know, that when there is a capital crime, that something like this, that the only time it rises to a capital punishment is obviously when the feds prosecute it. And the state kind of, you know, stays out of it in that way.
Right. And so, Nancy, I mean, you've sat on a federal bench. Do you think it's reasonable to include charges that do lead to a possible death penalty?
You're asking me the hardest question in the world. This was the question I was asked when I became a judge. Could I impose a death penalty? I'm not so happy with the way in which the death penalty charges have been brought. Putting aside Tsarnaev, I sat on a death penalty case involving four black kids who were accused of killing members of a rival gang. And so it was not the kind of weapons of mass destruction kind of case. It gives me pause. One part of me would love to see us stand for civilian enforcement of these laws, no death penalty. But I'm sure I'm in the minority on that.
Well, let's move to one court that's a step up higher than the federal court here in Massachusetts, and that is the United States Supreme Court and its rulings this week on the Defense of Marriage Act and California's Proposition 8. The court essentially, in a 5-4 decision, found parts of the Defense of Marriage Act unconstitutional. They sent back the Prop 8 ruling to the lower court in California. which basically made gay marriage legal in California. So here's James Essex. He is an ACLU lawyer who argued or represented Edith Windsor in the Defense of Marriage Act case. And here's a little tape from him.
But it's enormously gratifying to read this decision that says DOMA is just, it violates fundamental principles of equality. It shouldn't be that the federal government gets to treat the marriages of straight people one way and the marriages of gay people another way. And that's been our argument all along, and just wow.
So, Scott, what the court did is they took their ruling focused specifically on federal benefits regarding couples who are same-sex married couples across the United States. What it let stand was the provision of DOMA that allows states that do not recognize same-sex marriages to continue on down that path. First of all, let's start with the dual nature of that ruling, what you make of that.
Well, it is a little odd. This is not my original observation. I don't want to claim it is. But for the court the court to write, or Anthony Kennedy to write about the fundamental, you know, loss of dignity or being denied marriage, and then essentially to say, but that only pertains in those cases where states themselves haven't outlawed it or have legalized. I mean, it is a little bit of a odd dual mentality, but probably with this court, it's about the best you could hope for. And I think it lets the struggle go on, I guess, in kind of an organic way at the state level. And I think outside much of the South, you will see, I think you'll see a continuation of more and more states legalizing gay marriage. You might even see some migration of gay couples from states that don't to states that do, which frankly I think would redound to the largely to the intellectual benefit of the states that do. I think that a lot of gay couples, very, very, you know, smart together, career oriented, you know, do very well. And I think that would be a big asset. It'd be interesting to see if some of them would say, well, I'm not inclined to live in Georgia or Alabama, mm-hmm. Mississippi, Texas. I would rather, you know, come and live and work in Massachusetts or Connecticut or someplace like that.
Nancy, I see you shaking your head there. While the gay marriage rulings were the headline grabbing ones this week, there were also, it sort of fell in a group of rulings that has to do with civil rights in America.
Right. What the court gave with one hand, it took away with the rest of the hands, their hands. The gay marriage decision was an incremental decision. It had enormous effect, but it's incremental in the sense that the court says federalism demands states determine who gets married. On the other hand, this violated equal protection. So while they only covered the states that have same-sex marriage, there's no question that the rationale of the decision will be used all across the country to challenge bars on same-sex marriage. They didn't have to go much more than they did just by validating an equal protection challenge. Even in this limited setting, they've opened up the doors.
They've offered the legal
rationale.
They've
opened up the doors, yeah, all around the country. But on the other hand, while this took away the bar to same-sex marriage federal benefits, the court was extraordinarily bad with respect to civil rights cases. The court held in two decisions that got overwhelmed by the voting rights decision and by DOMA, substantially narrowed the application of the employment discrimination laws, so that if tomorrow we have same-sex marriage all across the United States and now we begin to talk about the enforcement of anti-sexual preference discrimination, those laws will not be very robust because
right,
they've been dissolved by the Supreme Court.
Well, let
Court.
Me ask both of you briefly, what do you make of that? Is that the court seemingly being inconsistent or consistent in its own way given the divide on the bench?
I think it's consistent in this regard. It's, you know, it's almost a version of the legal version of post-racial societies. We're going to take away overt, explicit discrimination. We're going to take the signs down, no women apply, you know, women only or black only. But when we get to anything more complicated than that, more nuanced than that, then that on the level of enforcement, you're on your own. Mm. That's pretty much what this is, because all across the country, civil rights claims are losing.
Scott, your thoughts?
Well, more and more, I think this court, it isn't so much as the court consistency, it's Anthony Kennedy consistent, because he's a swing decision, the swing vote on a lot of this stuff. And I guess you could say that he believes, on the one hand, that in the DOMA thing, that states should have a lot of prerogative, and he believed in the voting rights case that states should have more prerogative and they had less oversight by the federal government. I'm not sure I agree with that. I do think that the dissent there was pretty powerful, cataloging the the list of recent voter hijinks, I guess, for lack of a better word, voter suppression techniques that you've seen in the South. But on the other hand, you know, you do hear people say, look, it is a very new South, and it isn't fair to hold the South to a level of regard that you had in, or lack of regard that you had in 1965.
But the Voting Rights Act was a procedural device. It enabled you to challenge a regulation limiting voting rights before the election. It was procedural. If the New South is the New South, they would have passed these hurdles. So it really is just enabling a review in advance so that this wasn't going to be a problem. I mean, if there's a voting problem, by the time it's litigated through the courts, the election is taken place. This is a procedural device, which it seems to me is not a calamity for even the New South.
Hmm. Well,
that's a better point than mine.
We will allow the former federal judge to take that point. But let's move on to the other branch of the federal government, and that is in Congress, because Massachusetts voters this week also elected a new senator in our seemingly unending election cycle in this state. Voters picked by a 10-point margin Congressman Ed Markey to take the seat that was once held by now Secretary of State John Kerry. And here is Ed Markey in his victory speech.
I am going to the United States Senate to build a bold and bright future filled with optimism and opportunity for every family in the state of Massachusetts and across our great country.
And here's his Republican challenger, Gabriel Gomez, in his concession speech.
I heard a lot of people say that I shouldn't run. You've never been in politics. You're in Massachusetts. There's no way a Republican can win in Massachusetts. And they told me that the votes were just going to go blindly to a Democrat. They were wrong. And tonight, even in defeat, I've never been prouder to be a citizen of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Scott, let's start with you. Given that the turnout was so low, and in fact, I believe I saw the number that said the total amount of votes cast this time around was less than the number of votes either Scott Brown or Martha Coakley, one of them individually, got in 2010. What can we really discern from, you know, in terms of the mood of the Massachusetts electorate regarding, you know, who they want to send to Congress?
Well, I think there's a little bit of election fatigue that's set in. We're rolling into, of course, now a mayor's race, and after that there will be a governor's race, and there also will be another Senate race coming up, because it's only to fill the end of Kerry's term. But I also think the season, it's just very strange for people to think about going to the polls to vote in June in the, you know, in this case in quite hot weather.
On a 90-degree day, right.
I think the process needs to be reworked yet again, and I do believe they should be in November, when people are accustomed to voting, and that maybe we should appoint a kind of an honorable fill-in in the mode of Paul Kirk, and for maybe a little longer period if you need to, but have the election on a cycle that is a little more what people are used to. But I also got to say, I think this campaign was quite dull. I think that Ed Markey, I think he's a very knowledgeable and sophisticated guy, but he tried to expose as absolute little of his political posture as he could to any position that you could challenge. And I think that Gabe Gomez, while a very nice guy, didn't really come to this race having done the intellectual work he needed to. So you didn't have a campaign that was about the challenges that faced the country, really, in a realistic or intelligent or candid way. Rather, you had a thing that was about mostly just sort of, you know, I don't want to say completely symbolic, but talking points and wedge issues, and not intellectually an interesting exercise.
Well, Nancy, let me ask you about that, because there's been a lot of talk after the election about whether or not Gomez's 10-point defeat means that the problem was with the candidate, or is the problem with the Massachusetts Republican Party? Should Scott Brown have won, et cetera? You know, I'm just wondering if we can extract any sort of conclusion when we have, you know, barely a million and a half people casting ballots.
Yeah, I don't think that there's any conclusion. I mean, I think that the Republican Party is having a rough time nationally figuring out who it is. And that's exacerbated in Massachusetts because of the Massachusetts politics, and to some degree reflected in Gomez, who you simply could not figure out who he wanted to be. Was he pro-choice or not at all? Was he, you know, pro-growth? And what did that mean? I mean, he was neither fish nor fowl in lots of ways. So if the Republican Party nationally is having trouble having it uniquely in Massachusetts, he had all those problems.
Yeah, it seems like a double trap for Republicans
right.
in Massachusetts.
You didn't even really know what his philosophy was. You tried to say, well, what is your economic philosophy? Are you a George Mason type of, you know, an Austerian? Are you a Chicago schooler? Are you a Keynesian of some sort? What informs your view? And he wouldn't give you that. And also, there's a large structural problem, obviously, about sending a Republican down there because it will enable Mitch McConnell and much more conservative Republicans. So here, a candidate has to come up with a way to neutralize or at least finesse that. And they clearly had not thought
enough
about that.
It does make
you
wonder if the next non-Democratic, viable challenger might come from the ranks of independents.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, I think that is possible in this state where the Republican Party anyway doesn't have much of a toehold.
Yeah. Well, we've got just enough time for our hubbubs today. This was a Formula One version of a week in review. We're racing through it all because there's so much news. Nancy, let's start with your hubbub.
Well, I have a really silly one. I was intrigued, as most of the country was, with Wendy Davis and her filibuster.
I watched that, by the way, online on the live stream that night. It was incredible.
But I have to admit that after a while, I began to lose complete track of what she was saying and was only wondering how she did it. A question answered by the word catheter.
Oh, really?
So I'm sure that there were much more important takeaways from that, but that's all I kept on thinking about.
Well, the rules of a Texas filibuster are much more stringent than they are in Washington. You
right.
have to stay on topic. You can't lean against anything.
Right, but it was pretty nasty. It had to have been pretty nasty.
Well, it was, when midnight finally rolled around and the gallery full of Texas citizens exploded into, I don't know if you want to call it some civil disobedience to delay the vote. It was an incredible thing to witness.
It was extraordinary.
So Wendy Davis being propelled there onto the national scene.
Right.
Scott Lehigh, your hubbub for
this is just my theory, but I think we've gone from being what Mayor Menino used to call title town when we won championships to playoff town when we're quite content to do reasonably well in a playoffs like as the Bruins did, and I think that's a mark of maturity for Boston.
Oh, so we're growing up as sports fans?
Well, we're satisfied with good, strong, interesting, competitive performances rather than sulking when we don't win.
Okay. Oh, I don't think that's true. I'm sulking.
If Anthony were here, he would be sulking too.
Yeah.
He goes out of his way to tell us whenever we're in first place, but anyway.
Yeah, no, sulking.
Sulking. Well, my, Scott, you mentioned that it was really hot on election day, so my hubbub has to do with that. And the fact that sometime in the early afternoon, I believe, on Election Day, Mayor Tom Menino, or at least the account of Mayor Tom Menino, his Twitter account, sent out the following tweet. It was a tweet that said, "Ballot 799 in North End, almost skipped this one for Margs." As in margaritas, but civic duty won. Hashtag too hot to vote. First of all, the mayor did not cast his vote in the North End. He's a Hyde Park resident, as we know. Not necessarily known for his love of margaritas. And the tweet had a picture attached to it of the I voted signature or sticker. And the hand holding it had red nail polish on it. So people went crazy online and said, you know, oh, I didn't know you loved red nail polish, Mr. Mayor. Didn't know you voted in Hyde Park.
In the North End.
Oh, sorry, in the North End. But he quickly sent out a follow-up tweet that said, though I love the red nail polish and civic engagement, I voted in Hyde Park today. Earlier tweet, not my own. And then he added the hashtag, it's never too hot to vote. I did send him a tweet, though, that said, we're sure you'd still have looked smashing in red, though. So for on that note, Nancy Gertner not wearing a red jacket today.
Yes,
Harvard Law School professor and former federal judge in Massachusetts. Always great to have you. Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
And Scott Lehigh, columnist for the Boston Globe. Great to have you as well. Have a great weekend.
My pleasure. You too.
And listeners, send us your tweets as always. We're at Radio Boston. Stick with us because coming up next, we'll talk about the overturned murder conviction of a Plymouth Marine. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.